Welcome, everyone, to the Poker Pro podcast series. My name is Annie Jennings, and I am the host of this event today. We are at the Trump Taj Mahal in Atlantic City. The Taj Mahal today is hosting the Play the Authors No Limit Texas Hold'em tournament. We have with us right now one of the authors showcased in the tournament, and his name is Daniel Kimberg. Daniel Kimberg is the author of the book
Serious Poker.
Serious Poker. Absolutely, Daniel. Serious Poker. So we want to hear your story today. Daniel is one of the authors showcased today. Daniel would like to tell us about what it was like for him. Daniel, today, how many hands did you play?
I think I played four today. All
right.
Pretty good showing. A lot of people played only three, so...
Terrific.
I have more to tell you about the train ride over, really, than about the tournament. But
well, tell me a little bit about the hands that you played and what happened to you, and absolutely, you know, what finally knocked you out of the tournament.
Sure. Well, after a long and gruesome look at three pretty boring hands, I finally caught something I liked, which was a chance to get in cheaply with King 9 of hearts. I thought it was a pretty good hand, and I liked it even better when the flop came all in hearts.
Okay,
of course, with the King High flush, you're always in danger of an Ace High flush. Turns out that was already out there. I didn't even need to wait for a fourth heart. And I put in a pretty sizable raise, and my opponent put in an even more sizable raise. At this point, I had no choice but to suspect he had the ace high flush. Of course, I suspected it. I chose not to act on that suspicion, and now I'm here.
All right, so that's interesting. You know, I find that to be a common theme where you get a sense that perhaps you are beat, but you still are willing to play the game. Did that happen to you today?
Well, yeah, actually, in early on in a tournament, the strategy is very much like a side game tournament, like a side game, no limit game, in which we'll basically play any hand that's profitable. We'll make an expected chip profit on the hand. So in this case, I had to, since the bet I was facing was so much larger than the pot, I basically had to believe that there was a decent chance of winning the hand. I didn't have to believe that I was necessarily the best, but I had to believe that I was. You can think of it as the pot was offering me even odds on my money.
Right, exactly.
So much larger were the bets.
Right.
So I figured there was an excellent chance that he had a jack high flush, queen high flush, something of that sort.
I know better.
And if I thought that it was even 50% likely, then it was right to call. And I did, especially this early in the tournament, and I was wrong.
Did you go all in at that point?
Well, he went all in first, so that's why I was faced with a very, very clear mathematical decision. Since his bet was so much larger than the pot, I thought the chances were that he had an ace high flush as opposed to some other hand.
Sure. Absolutely. Now, if you had a couple of secrets that you wanted to share now with our listening podcast audience, what would they be? Do you have any in particular you'd like to share?
Well, I'm having a little trouble with the concept of secrets I'd like to share, but I'll tell you one thing that I think is something that a lot of people should know but don't, which is that when you sit down at a poker table and you look around at the other players at the table, I think most of the time you're looking at a lot of players who could play better than they're playing right at that moment. So even if you're playing with a lot of players who are capable of outplaying you, who in some abstract way are better players than you, that doesn't mean that you're the worst player at the table at that moment. And I think this is something that a lot of people overlook. You may look around and see a lot of intimidating players, but by playing your best all the time, you can actually have an advantage even when you're not generally the best player at the table, or when there are a lot of players that outclass you in terms of their abstract knowledge of the computer.
This one's written, then you get to it.
Now tell me today, did you see any other players, of course, make critical mistakes that you felt actually doomed themselves as well?
Well, it wasn't much time. I saw the same mistake that I see pretty often at these games, which is players making undersized raises before the flop.
I know. Get the edge.
There are times when that's probably a good idea, but they occur less frequently than you actually see that bet. So I would say that that's the mistake I saw.
That's right. And the undersized raise leads to what other mistake?
Well, it doesn't necessarily have to lead to another mistake. So you may play perfectly after that. I think what happens often is that by making an undersized raise, you let a lot of people into the pot at a good price. You may play perfectly well.
I don't know that.
Stop looking at it.
You could have had you been on top of your game.
You have some children you want to give them? My grands?
Put to a more difficult position.
That's right. I have a question for you. What do you feel is the optimal size raise before the flop?
Well, you know, it always depends on the exact situation. You have to know what the players around you are capable of doing and what they're doing right at the moment. I tend to think feel like you want to go with it. At the very least, you don't want to raise any kind of suspicion by making an unusual size bet. So within that constraint, I would say that usually at least 3 to 4 times the size of the big blind is a pretty standard bet that gives your opponents poor odds for hands that are not high quality hands.
Now, would you consider you had a bad beat today?
No. I mean, I don't really like to use the term bad beat at all anyway. I think it's a pretty standard beat. A lot of times you have a hand that is destined for doom, and making a second best, you know, a second nut flush in a situation where you should lose a lot of money. Is it a bad beat? Well, it's poker.
But you really had no choice because you did have a king high flush.
Well, yeah, certainly in another situation in the tournament, had I known this player better, you know, there are a lot of ways that I could have gotten off his hand, but I don't think so in the situation I was in. Especially so early in the tournament where I'm really playing a money game, where it's really a question of making the most profitable call in terms of chips, as opposed to later on in the tournament where you're trying to make the most profitable decision in terms of tournament money, which is often a very different decision. So I don't have any regrets about how I played. I have regrets about how it turned out, of course.
Well, I'll tell you what. Since you are the book author of Serious Poker, how about if we ask Daniel right now of any kind of, maybe if you've got some of your 5 top tips that you'd like to share that are outlined in your book a little more in detail.
Now, bearing in mind that my book is intended to get new players into the game. So it was originally written back, I guess I actually wrote it in 1998, back before poker's big boom. The idea being to introduce players who are familiar with casual poker to the game of serious poker. So I think the things that I would recommend that casual players or even players who've begun to take the game more seriously start to keep in mind that they might not have already thought about is the importance of record keeping, the importance of reading and always constantly studying and learning, the importance of, and not everybody's equally cut out for this, the importance of mathematical analysis of their game. Or at least logical analysis, some kind of thought-out analysis that goes beyond sitting around with your friends and
sure.
talking it over.
Do you feel impulse play could be a player's downfall? They just feel they have a feeling that they're going to win the pot, and therefore they act on impulse rather than statistical probability that they've got the best hand?
Well, I think those things have to go hand in hand. I think there are so many poker decisions, especially when you're talking about no limit, that can't be made simply on the basis of mathematics. You have to be judging in your mind what you think that player is likely to do in a situation. So it's obviously a game of imperfect information, and I think if you actually sit down and do the mathematical analysis, you'll realize that there are lots of little places in the equations where you have to fill in the probability of this player doing this move with this hand, the probability of him holding this hand in this situation. And all of a sudden, once you're starting to make those decisions, you realize that your gut instinct is as important to mathematical analysis as the actual math is.
Yeah, which actually makes the game fun, actually, because there's that wild card of instinct, right? And gut feel at a certain point.
It's extremely important, and the more you play no-limit poker, poker against very skilled opponents, these things become much more important. If you're playing a lot of low-limit poker where a lot of players see the flop, and poker where... limit poker in general. Getting these kinds of, often the mathematics that don't have to do with your opponent's holdings or your opponent's psychology will dominate your decisions. But I think a tournament poker, and especially in no limit poker of all kinds.
Yeah, I think one of the important things to come out of today's experience that you had is that a lot of people feel like they just can't go up against the pros and win, or they can't go up against obviously better players and win. Do you believe that to be true?
Well, the question is, you know, poker is a game of the long term, and outcomes are in the short term. So, obviously, in the short term, really bad players can do very well. Depending on how exactly they structure their playing, a really bad player could go a year of you know, intermittent but you know, continuous play and feel like they're doing pretty well. Especially if we're talking about tournament outcomes, where you can drive an entire year's profitable results with one or two outcomes. You know, it's a question of the horizon of the time frame you're talking about. So, I think I always tell people that you can't go. I used to say Andre Agassi. You can't go up against Andre Agassi and expect to take a point off him. I guess now it would be Roger Federer, but you don't really want to play that kind of game. And the same thing is true if you're 5'4". You don't want to get involved in a lot of like height competitions because you know you're going to lose every time. But if you're playing against poker, the short-term results are dominated by the inherent variability of the game due to the randomness of the cards.
That's right. So you would recommend to players who really want to improve their game and become pros, what would you recommend that they do?
Well, the first thing I think is it's important is to study. Read. And now, as the author of a book, I have a little bit of an interest in that. But more importantly, I think what's really important to consider is that when you try to figure things out on your own, you're reinventing the wheel. And there are lots of wheels to invent in poker. There's lots of interesting things to know about poker, and a lot of them have been invented already, and you can save yourself a lot of time. So just as an expedient, you don't want to try to recreate on your own, even if you turn out to be the most brilliant poker analyst of all time. You still don't want to spend your time trying to reinvent all those wheels. So I would say that the single most important thing is to study by finding out what has gone before, what people have already learned.
Right, and study and then implement, right? Play a few games, implement what you've learned, and then go back to the drawing board once you've reached other challenges in the game.
So the second most important thing is probably, and you know, these go hand in hand. I wouldn't say that, you know, one of these is all you need, but is record keeping, so that you can actually take your results back and look at what you've done, look over the decisions that you've made, not just how they've worked out, which is usually a very misleading type of feedback, but look at the decisions and analyze them later and see if they were the right decisions based on the information you had at the time. So I would say record keeping and analysis goes really hand in hand with trying to learn.
Sure, and I have a question for you. How do you categorize players at the table? I know we have the loose aggressive, the tight aggressive, we've got the passive players. Is there a key that you use that tips you off to what type of player you're playing against and what strategy to use?
Well, I think, I'm fortunate in some sense that I don't go up against world-class competition all the time. So players do pigeonhole themselves reasonably well, although there are lots of skilled players at these days at whatever level you play, even players who will go on to play higher limits or bigger events that, you know, just haven't made it that far yet. But I think pretty much, you know, I think when you look at players and their frequency of raises, their frequency of entering the pot is certainly probably the most reliable indicator of what style of play they're trying to accomplish. You look at players who have seen players on TV, like for example, Sammy Farha got a lot of TV time a few years ago. And even though you only see a selection of the hands, it's pretty well known that he does like to enter a lot of pots.
Sure.
And a lot of players emulate that style without the kind of skill that usually needs to go along with it in order to have success in even low-level tournament play. So
I guess that's the appeal of the game. You've got so many players with so many different personality characteristics that play in so many different styles and strategies. It's fun. It's a real mind workout.
Yeah, I think what's a little counterintuitive is that you don't necessarily have to go outside your comfort zone by too far in order to be a successful poker player. There are lots of successful tournament poker players who don't play that hyper-aggressive style that gets so much airplay on TV. Now, to be sure, most of the most successful tournament players do have at least an element of that hyper-aggression to their game, but they have a lot more to go with it.
Right.
But there are certainly lots of other players. Dan Harrington has been phenomenally successful, and I don't think anybody would describe him as a wild and crazy player at the table.
No, in fact, quite patient.
Yeah, and there are other players, I guess I'm blanking on some of them, who can be quite aggressive when the time comes, but aren't necessarily known for their unbridled aggression. I think Eric Seidel is also a known player.
Right.
Like that.
Do you feel that being able to know when the time is right for you to play a particular hand, all the elements seem to be there, you're in good position, you seem to have good starting cards before the flop, you feel like it might have some good potential, the hand?
Well, like anything else, I think playing poker well is about as a sort of pattern recognition exercise. When you've played a lot, when you're familiar with a lot of situations, and you know, certainly this is an ongoing process. Even players who have been playing for years have new situations they can learn to recognize. But if you can recognize a situation quickly enough to make the right decision, I think it's certainly an avenue for success. Whereas trying to analyze the situation at the table as it happens is probably a great exercise if you can do it correctly, but probably a losing enterprise in the long run.
You know, right. And one of the final questions I'd like to ask you is, because everybody seems to have a bad beat story, and right now we're doing an interview with you, you know, based on the fact that, early on in the tournament you took a good risk, a strong risk, a statistically important and justifiable risk, but you were knocked out. You do not look at that as a bad beat. You just look at that as part of the game. Some players will take that that and use that to destroy their play for the next couple of games or whatever. How do you handle just knowing that, you know, this happened to you today, you're going to go back in there tomorrow and start fresh?
Yeah, I don't play quite that often, but I think the thing that I always liken poker players to dogs, and I think here's the thing that you need. If a dog wakes up in the morning and sees their owner for the same way that it happens every day, you know, they get very excited. The owner comes home at the end of the day, the dog gets very excited again. And as a poker player, you have to not be able to do that. So you have to basically be able to look at something that happens very, very frequently and say, you know, I've seen this before, and I'm not going to get excited about it this time.
Right.
Now, if you're playing at the World Series of Poker, and it's the final event, and it's the final table, and millions of dollars are at stake, well, nobody has that happen on a regular basis.
You know.
But when you get a $100 tournament, I think you need to get used to that.
I used to love when I would get pocket aces, and I would think, oh, my God, that's the best hand ever.
Sure.
Yeah, for that particular moment, it's the best hand.
Sure.
But then anything can happen. So it's really a game of just so much fun and uncertainty and strategy and probability. It's absolutely fascinating. I've got one final question for you, Daniel, and that is, why do you love the game?
Well, I think I actually, this is in the first paragraph of my book, I think. I love the game because it has a little bit of everything. If you like to gamble, it has that. If you like statistical analysis, it has that. If you like just, you know, the sort of being a big shot, throwing a lot of chips around, it has that. If you like the social aspect, it has that.
Right.
If you just like to spend an afternoon outside the house, it has that. And you can, pretty much any kind of activity that people enjoy, it has a little bit of an element of that.
Absolutely.
Poker players always say that, you know, poker is really the sort of root way of looking at things. Of course, you can get that same point of view from soccer players or people who take whatever their activity is seriously.
And you know what else I wonder, and while I have you here today, I'd really like to ask this question. Do you feel like basic personality flaws, not just your own now, I'm not speaking about you in general, but speaking about others, do you think certain personality flaws will stand in a person's way of their success unless they are identified and addressed?
Well, there are certainly people who are not cut out to play poker, and I think part of it is an unwillingness, sometimes a conscious unwillingness, not to make correct decisions. There are some people who are so risk-averse that they're not willing to take risks, even when they, at some deep level, know they're correct. I unfortunately know people like this, and
I
think it's some way of it's in their mind it's a way of expressing the fact that they're not necessarily playing poker for profit or something else that's more important to them.
I know, absolutely. Well, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you today, Daniel. Daniel's book is called Serious Poker. We've been speaking with Daniel Kimber. He is obviously a wonderful world-class poker player, no limit poker player as well. And we're very happy to have you here at the Taj Mahal. This is a live event, and we're hoping you'll come back with us and share some more tips and strategies for
Thanks.
Your followers.
I will certainly do that.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We'll see you again next time.
Thank you.